Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, I-17 southbound, an accident at 7th Street has the right lanes blocked. On the 101 southbound in the West Valley, an accident at Thunderbird has the right lane blocked. And on I-10 westbound, a collision at the 101. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon today. Look for a high of 89 degrees. Clear tonight, overnight lows in the mid-50s. It's 82 degrees right now.
Arizona could become even more gun-friendly by the end of this legislative session. More than half a dozen bills related to gun rights are pending right now, and that's worrying some Democrats, as KJZZ's Will Stone reports.
One bill would prohibit schools from banning firearms on streets around campus. Another forbids state and local government from requiring a search of federal or state databases before a private sale, gift, or transfer. A third would allow someone with a permit to bring a firearm into public places, like county buildings or libraries, unless security personnel and screening are present there. And all of this concerns Democratic Representative Randall Freese. His legislation to form a study committee about gun safety never even got heard by the House, he says.
This is not about taking away anyone's Second Amendment right. This is about adequately regulating and being certain that those who have a gun are safe, don't mean to use it to do harm.
But many of the pending bills have received broad support from Republican lawmakers who say these are critical measures to ensure Arizonans' Second Amendment rights. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A jury has convicted an Arizona man of conspiring to provide support to the so-called Islamic State terrorist group. Abdul Malik Abdul Karim was also found guilty today on other counts stemming from an attack last spring at a Prophet Muhammad cartoon contest in Texas. Authorities say Karim bankrolled and motivated two Islamic State followers who were killed in a shootout while trying to carry out a rampage at the anti-Islam event. Karim was also convicted of providing guns used in the May 3rd attack. Authorities say he and the two gunmen had researched travel to the Middle East to join Islamic State fighters. Karim has denied all the allegations.
State lawmakers have approved a bill that would allow the Attorney General to withhold state-shared revenues from any city that passes an ordinance that's in conflict with state law. Republican Representative Warren Peterson of Gilbert is one of the measure's sponsors and told his colleagues cities ask lawmakers to approve bills they want and then enforce those laws.
However, when we come up with ideas from constituents, small business owners, that if they don't want to enforce them, they just choose not to follow these laws. This is simple. This is an enforcement mechanism so that the laws are followed.
Both the House and Senate's approval of SB 1487 was generally along party lines. One of the bill's critics is Ken Strobeck, executive director of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns.
First of all, Senate Bill 1487 has so many unconstitutional provisions, we believe, ordering the Attorney General to initiate an investigation on the demand of a single member of the legislature, empowering the Attorney General to be not only the investigator but also the judge and jury in finding of fact and in instituting a penalty of a restriction of half of the shared revenue to a city or town if that one person determines they are in violation of the law or the Constitution. Shared revenue is something initiated and by the voters. It's an enormous part of a typical city or town's general fund operating budget. It's extremely heavy-handed. It interferes with the elected officials at the local level who are elected by their constituents to reflect community values and to enact statutes and ordinances that are reflective of the community. But probably the most offensive thing about it is that we're not talking about street criminals or people who are violating, you know, some sort of civil law. We're talking about elected officials, each of whom have sworn to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the state of Arizona.
Well, it's interesting you mention upholding the laws and the Constitution, because one of the arguments that supporters of this bill have said is that the legislature passes laws and then cities basically, in some cases, go around them and pass their own local ordinances, which these legislators say is not okay. So why is it okay, in your mind, for cities in some ways to go around some of these statewide laws?
All right. I don't believe there are cities that are passing local ordinances that are in direct violation of state law. If they are doing such a thing, that is in violation of the law, and there's a legal remedy to fix that, which is to file a lawsuit and have it adjudicated in a court of law the proper way, rather than to just have this attorney general do a one-person investigation and impose sentence.
Do you expect this law to generate a lawsuit?
I certainly think it's probably likely, because I am confident that if somebody, if the governor does sign it, that there will be immediate, you know, demands by legislators. It only takes one, according to this bill, to command the attorney general to initiate an investigation. And if there certainly is a finding and the local government disagrees with the finding of the attorney general, I certainly think there would be a lawsuit out of that.
Do you think that this bill will have any long-lasting ramifications as far as the relationship between the state and its cities?
I certainly think it could, you know, and I don't want to paint all legislators with the same brush. You know, it passed out of the House 32-28. Not everybody believes that that cities are out there as rogue lawbreakers, and it's a mischaracterization to paint them all with that brush. But it really does set up a relationship that is far less cooperative and mutually supportive, and it makes it a much more an atmosphere of mistrust and animosity.
Ken Strobeck is the executive director of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. Ken, thanks.
You're welcome, Mark.
Children in poverty are deeply affected not only by food deserts and a lesser number of nutritional options. The situation involves a long list of challenges that increase the stress on young brains. That's led the American Academy of Pediatrics to urge doctors to ask parents if they're doing okay financially. To learn more, I'm joined by Dr. Robin Blitz, Director of Developmental Pediatrics at the Barrow Neurological Institute at Phoenix Children's Hospital. Doctor, many of us will focus on how poverty affects child nourishment, but it goes much deeper than that, right?
It affects language development. If you're living in poverty and you don't have appropriate developmental stimulation because your mother or your father or both are working two or three jobs, or you're homeless, or you have food insecurity, and it's more important to the parents that they provide the child with food and shelter because that's all they have and they don't have the ability to have books around or developmentally appropriate toys. Children living in poverty have more chronic illness and less treatment for chronic illness and diseases and disorders, and children with chronic illness have more developmental and behavioral problems.
So the American Academy of Pediatrics is urging doctors to ask parents if they can make ends meet and if they're in a poverty situation. Have you had that conversation with a parent? How would a doctor approach that?
I have it with every single child and family that I see.
Is that a tough conversation to have?
I feel like I have a really good rapport with all of my families, and even with a new family, it's, you know, you certainly begin the visit with building a rapport and establishing the fact that, you know, my role here is to help your child be healthy developmentally, emotionally, and physically. I'm a developmental pediatrician, so general pediatricians refer me patients when there are developmental and behavioral problems. Mm-hmm. When I go through the family and social history, I ask questions. And in fact, it's now policy. Our nurses always ask the question to the parent, are you living in a safe environment? Is there anything that concerns you about your home? And certainly if I see those, if there are cues there, I address those. But I also always ask, you know, do you have books in your home? Especially our kids who may be on CPAP for sleep apnea or have feeding pumps or have nebulizers for asthma. I ask if they have electricity.
When you're talking to a parent about this and asking the information, does that raise the level of self-consciousness to the feeling of, well, I guess I'm not a good parent because I'm not able to provide these basics for my child? Is there a difficulty in a two-way street there trying to say, well, I'm asking you this because we want you to have this ability to get these resources for your child? Do parents always react knowing that you're coming from a good place?
I think most parents trust a pediatrician and other primary care providers. I don't want to leave out the family practice physicians who see many children. I actually, a long time ago, I had a patient and a father in and discovered bruises on the child, and the child told me that it was his dad who did this. It was a little bit of a scary situation for me because this man was a big man and I was the last person in the office. There was nobody left. And I told the dad that I had to call the police and took the child and walked out of the office with me and wow. called the police. And this man was arrested and ended up spending some time in jail. I saw this family a year and a half later with the mom and the child and the dad. And the dad walked in and shook my hand and thanked me because he became clean and sober and went through anger management and counseling. And now he was being a better father and a better husband to his family.
Dr. Robin Blitz is Director of Developmental Pediatrics at the Barrow Neurological Institute at Phoenix Children's Hospital.
Maricopa County tops the state in terms of health outcomes. That's according to a new report from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which measured health across every county in the country. Katie Weir is a program officer with the group. And Katie, it looks like overall, more populated and urban counties fared better than smaller, more rural ones. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
That is a fair assessment. And it's actually a trend that we're seeing across the country, where nearly one in five rural counties have experienced level or rising premature death rates over the past decade, while rates in large urban counties have continued to improve. And I think this is particularly troubling because rural counties make up two-thirds of all counties. And so what does that mean for individuals across the nation and particularly to Arizona?
Maricopa County, the state's biggest by a wide margin, came out top as far as health outcomes in your report. What is it that Maricopa County is doing well?
Maricopa County continues to improve, not only in its premature death rate, but other areas such as improving access to exercise or mammography screening and diabetic monitoring, as well as to improve clean air. But there are some areas where it needs to continue to improve. So whether it's thinking about violent crime or children living in poverty or unemployment. So it says that just because you're the leading county within a state, it doesn't mean that there still aren't areas for improvement.
One of the areas that the report suggested that Maricopa County was doing well, especially in terms of the behaviors category, it seems like county residents here like to exercise quite a bit and do so more perhaps than in other places. I'm wondering how much of that, and maybe you found this in other parts of the country as well, how much of that is just the availability of places and the climate where you can exercise. You know, you take a hike pretty much any time of the year other than the summer, whereas in some places you don't have those kinds of parks, you don't have those kinds of trails, things like that.
Well, it's interesting to think about Maricopa County for that reason, both in terms of what access looks like. So if you look at the data, you see access to exercise opportunities being really high, and yet you see physical inactivity rates being pretty low. So there's certainly a correspondence there. I think, though, what's important to keep in mind is that no matter which kind of climate you live in or which kind of environment you have, that communities are thinking really creatively about how to take advantage of existing resources. So, for instance, with schools, when schools are out of session, is there a way to open up the gyms in a different way to communities in order for them to be able to utilize those spaces after hours to get physical activity?
When you talk about urban versus rural counties and just sort of counties in general, how much of trying to close some of these gaps just comes down to resources and specifically money?
Certainly money and financial capital make a huge difference within communities. And yet we recognize that poverty or access to resources such as availability of businesses or tax rates aren't the only thing that contribute to better health. We recognize that there are low cost and no cost opportunities to take on. There are also ways to think about what are decisions that are already being made that if we take into account health, we could actually make it better.
Katie Weir is a program officer with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. We'll post the results for Arizona at theshow.kjzz.org. When people think about endangered species, polar bears and condors may come to mind. But now an ASU researcher says wildlife managers should change the way they allocate money to preserve and grow lesser-known endangered species. KJZZ science and innovation correspondent Andrew Bernier joins me with more. Hi, Andrew.
Hello, Mark.
So you spoke with the researcher. What did you find out?
Well, to start, the Endangered Species Act is 40 years old. It has 1,125 species on it and receives an annual budget of $1.2 billion. Conservation biologist Leah Gerber with ASU School of Life Sciences found that over that time, while the total funding has been adequate, some species got a lot of money while others don't.
There are species that are actually receiving more than the recovery team specifies is required. So shift the surplus funds from those top 50 overfunded species to those that are severely underfunded. And by doing that, we would erase the funding deficit for more than 180 species.
What kinds of species does Gerber think get too much money and which does she think don't get enough?
Basically, she says the cute, cuddly ones get disproportionate attention and money, while some plants and invertebrates, often others, could use a little more love and cash.
So does she propose an alternative method to allocate money?
Well, Gerber advocates a return on investment approach meant to reallocate funds without requesting more money. She believes funding should be based on how species have either improved, stagnated, or declined in population.
Well, how would she determine that? I mean, how would she characterize how a particular species is doing?
Well, Gerber breaks down the species into four different classifications. So the first one is cost-effective, which means the species is fully funded and that their population is increasing. The second is what she calls a costly success, meaning that it is overfunded, but the populations themselves are increasing. And then there's injurious neglect, which means the species is underfunded and the populations are declining. And then the last one is what's known as a costly failure, meaning that the species is overfunded and also the populations are declining. So Gerber says if we were to shift funding from species in the costly success and the costly failure categories to, say, the injurious neglected species, we may see a growth in those populations. For example, Gerber says that there are 7 cacti in Arizona on the endangered species list.
The Acuna cactus is one. It's listed as endangered. And the primary threat is development and also mining operations. There are only 5 locales in Arizona where these cacti exist, and only one of them is protected. That's in Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument.
And Andrew, there is actually a bit of news about the Acuna cactus, right?
Right. So earlier this week, a petition was submitted by mining company Freeport-McMoRan to actually have the Acuna cactus delisted, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service found that to be non-substantial. So basically what that means is the company claimed that the cactus' taxonomic classification gave it a much larger landmass, so assuming there would be more of the cactus itself. But upon review, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service found that the current taxonomy of the cactus was correct, and so with that, they declined any further review of possible delisting.
So it stays where it is.
It sure does.
That's KJZZ's Andrew Bernier. Andrew, thanks.
Hey, my pleasure, Mark.
The Pima County Board of Supervisors is moving toward a plan to give all county employees 6 weeks of paid maternity or paternity leave. The supervisors adopted the policy but still have to approve it as part of the budget process this spring. It could take effect as early as July 1st. Under the plan, new parents would be able to take the time and get 66% of their salary over those 6 weeks. Alan Bolzomi is Director of Human Resources for Pima County. And Alan, how did the county come up with that percentage of worker salary?
That's a good question. That was an edit that one of the Board of Supervisors made, Mr. Elias. The union had been recommending 75%, and I believe our county administrator had given an option of 50%, and he picked 66%.
How would this work within the confines of FMLA, the Family Medical Leave Act, which allows workers to basically take time off unpaid if they don't have sick or vacation time, or paid at their full salary if they have that much time off for things like the birth of a child, among other things?
Right. It allows up to 12 weeks of FMLA leave unpaid. For this leave, it would run concurrently. So if you took 6 weeks of paid leave, you would have burned up 6 weeks of your FMLA leave.
How much do you expect that this could potentially cost the county on a yearly basis?
Well, the numbers have moved around a bit. When we first started costing this out, the maximum cost could have been $1.6 million, and that was at 100% salary, and then we've made these reductions. At 66%, we're looking at probably less than $500,000. What also would mitigate that as part of the proposal is it would eliminate the ability to use our catastrophic leave bank for this type of leave, which should further reduce the cost.
Are there other governmental entities that you know of that do something like this?
There are no other public entities in Arizona that do it other than the University of Arizona. University of Arizona is implementing this. They passed it a few months ago. But we could not find any other, when we were doing the research, we couldn't find any other governmental agency in Arizona. It is a program that is in place such as California. It's actually a state program. In the state of California, everybody that works there pays into the SDI or state disability insurance program. And when you take off for paternity leave or parental leave in California, you actually get paid 66 2/3 by the state of California.
Will workers in Pima County have to contribute to a fund to pay for this, or is this something that's coming out of the county's general fund?
No, this will come out of the county funds.
Alan Bolzomi is Director of Human Resources for Pima County. Alan, thanks.
You're welcome.
Self-driving cars might seem like the ride of the future, but the future is now. Governor Doug Ducey recently appointed an oversight committee to race ahead of the technology. NKJZZ's Lauren Gilger spoke with one of the people on that committee. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Mark.
So how far off are we from this technology taking over the roads?
The technology is here, and the question now is how can states have a role in implementing it? I talked to Kevin Beastie. He's the Deputy Director for Policy at the Arizona Department of Transportation, and he says autonomous vehicles are being tested across the country and, as we've discussed on the show, on roads here in Arizona.
What we like to say is that the technology is, or at least the implementation, is going to be evolutionary rather than revolutionary. You talk to the manufacturers, and they have already started implementing autonomous technology in vehicles. You got lane departure warnings. You have automatic braking and distance control. So the issue has always been that you have multiple companies, both startup technology companies and some of our historic automakers, all involved in this at various degrees. And the states and localities have to be at the table because we have to be part of the discussion about what kind of infrastructure these vehicles are going to need, what kind of technologies we may need to implement within the roadways.
So the governor's oversight committee is made up of experts from the public safety world, from the transportation world, the Department of Insurance, and the University of Arizona. And they're looking for opportunities to advance these technologies in the state and get rid of any regulation that they say could get in the way.
What is ADOT's role in all of this?
They're the transportation experts here, and Beastie says ADOT wants to be involved now because they have to know what kind of infrastructure they need to build in the future. He says some manufacturers are building self-driving cars that use optics and require clear line delineations on the road, and others are using GPS, and ADOT needs to plan now. Here's Beastie.
You'll hear a lot of V2I. That's vehicle-to-infrastructure communication. There's V2V, vehicle-to-vehicle communication. So a V2I example might be sensors in the roadway that will help guide the vehicle through intersections or interchanges. V2V technology is where one of the things we're really interested in looking at in Arizona is connected vehicles with regard to commercial traffic. Platooning trucks. The early research shows that you can gain a lot of efficiencies both in energy, time, and savings in shipping costs if you can keep trucks closer together and moving at the same speed and being able to brake and operate at the same time. Think of it like a train without any, but is electronically connected.
So he's saying fleets of trucks like this may have their own lanes on the roads in the not-so-distant future.
And there are a lot of other potential uses for self-driving cars. Where does he think it's going?
Yeah, the more you dig into this, the more possibilities seem to come up. Beastie says this technology is going to change our mobility options. Think about what this could do for people who are blind or the elderly.
But the big question, Lauren, always is, what about safety?
Right. There are definitely liability issues that need to be figured out. Who would be at fault if there were an accident? But Beastie says there are a slew of controlled tests and studies that show self-driving cars would be safer than having people drive them. And he says it really comes down to one thing.
You know, last I checked, computers don't drink alcohol or take drugs. And so we believe there would be an increase in highway safety, decrease in fatalities and accidents.
That's Kevin Beastie, Deputy Director for Policy at the Arizona Department of Transportation. He's on the governor's new self-driving vehicle oversight committee.
KJZZ's Lauren Gilger. Lauren, thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Mike Millmine. I'm retired, so I play with my cars. I'm at the Pavilions Car Show. You can always tell the people that's really done the engine work. You could probably eat off their engines cleaner than the plates in a lot of restaurants. Some weekends you'll come in here and you'll see a $2 million Bugatti Veyron sitting next to you. You see racers here, you know, you see the little rice cars with the big tomato can mufflers on them. You get a little hodgepodge of everything. That's what's kind of fun.
That's Mike Millmine with his red Corvette at the Scottsdale Pavilion's car show. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
The effort to preserve and protect American Indian sites in north-central Arizona is going high-tech. The Verde Valley Archaeology Center next month is going to be testing out a device that monitors activity, among other things, and can send text or email alerts if it picks up on something. It's being loaned to the center, but others being tested at Bandelier National Monument in New Mexico. Ken Zoll is the executive director of the Verde Valley Archaeology Center, and he joins me. Ken, what are you trying to do with this?
Well, there's been a number of instances of vandalism here in the Sedona, Verde Valley area for a number of years. And so there is a program statewide. Arizona State Parks runs it. It's called the Arizona Site Steward Program. And they recruit individual volunteers to go to different sites and just monitor them at least once a year and report any kind of signs of vandalism. Well, here in the Sedona Verde Valley area, we have 160 sites that have been designated by the Prescott National Forest and the Coconino National Forest as needing this type of site steward visits because of the potential for vandalism. Now, that's 160 sites out of more than 2,500 that are recorded here in the area. So it's quite a big task to try to even patrol the 160. And so the Verde Valley Archaeology Center, we decided that we needed to do something to support the state site steward program. And so we created our own little program called the Verde Valley Site Watch Program. And while we were going through all of that, we became aware of a grant that was issued by the National Park Service last year. What they were trying to do with the grant is have this firm adapt a electronic monitoring system that was developed for wildlife poaching and real-time reporting. And so essentially it's a monitoring station that is situated at a particular site. It has real-time satellite communication and relay back to the land manager's office. And it can detect when people, it can detect motion, so it can detect when people come into the area. They could even detect whether or not somebody's carrying a shovel, for example. So there's some metal detection as well. And there's some facial recognition that goes with this as well.
This sounds like pretty high-tech stuff. What would be the cost if you were to have to buy these in order to deploy them at all of your sites, or even some of your sites?
The estimated cost at this point is $2,000 per unit, which isn't all that great. And, of course, the more you buy, probably the price goes down. The biggest price actually is the satellite connection, and that comes to about $250 a month. But they're working on a version that would allow you to use existing cell towers.
Do you think that the ultimate goal of deploying these would be to catch people who are vandalizing these sites or to deter them from doing it in the first place?
Well, it's actually probably a little bit of both, but primarily deterrence. One of the things we've worked on with the existing program, our Verde Valley Site Watch, is we've talked to the forests and with the national, the state parks with their site steward program, and we've developed a relatively inobtrusive sign that would go to these various sites. And basically, it starts off by not saying, you know, don't do anything, because those never seem to work. It starts off by pointing out that the site you're now about to visit is still considered sacred to Native American cultures, and please respect it when you enter the area. But, by the way, the site is either monitored by Arizona site stewards or electronically. And so it kind of gives them, with a sign, a little notice that, well, if you don't want to be monitored, turn around. And if you're thinking of vandalizing, you might get caught.
Ken Zoll is the executive director of the Verde Valley Archaeology Center in Camp Verde. Ken, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Countless sci-fi novels and films have delved into what could happen if humans created robots or other machines with artificial intelligence, and they either become almost human best friends and companions, or they turn into megalomaniacs with the goal of turning us into their slaves. The reality of artificial intelligence, or AI, is that scientists have developed robots that can beat us at chess, but there are significant nuances that are still missing. With me to talk about that is Rao Kemenpati, professor of computer science and engineering at ASU. Rao, why are we missing the emotional components, a key part of being human, in artificial intelligence?
There's this distinction that we, most of us, have in our own minds as to human versus intelligent human. And who we talk of as intelligent people, typically we don't think of them as the people who can see well, etc. But we tend to think of them as people who can do calculus better, who can play chess better. So what happened, interestingly, in AI is the kinds of capabilities human babies and human children have, which we just take for granted, for which you don't get, you know, university degrees, you don't get any awards, nothing. Right. These wound up being, they're actually more open problems for computers still. Whereas the kinds of things that people go to colleges for, such as being expert in an area, being able to solve problems, being able to play chess and so on, they became the first things that AI actually excelled in. Certain things were actually turned out to be easier to automate. And ironically, those are the things that people think are hard. You know, you think, people think playing chess is hard. People don't think looking at people's faces is hard. It turns out that doing faces, doing a speech, etc., it took us longer time to figure out how to do that.
When we're in a position of, let's say, creating a more complex machine and one that can do more things for us, or with which we can team, or in order to do things more rapidly or more efficiently, why is it that we then desire to have that machine be more like us?
That's very interesting question. So in some sense, you know, when I teach the intro to AI to my students, I find that, I mean, as humans, as a race, human race, we're incredibly self-centered. So when we think of aliens, they will always have an eye. Maybe they'll have three eyes, they'll maybe four eyes. Nothing looks like a block. And that's one aspect. The other aspect is we actually will see human features in everything. You know, I grew up in India, and then it's like we will basically see some rocks with slight different features, just like this Rorschach test, the bread slice which has Mother Mary on it, and so on. So we are just right. Basically, evolutionarily, we are hard-coded to look for human faces, human expressions, human everything everywhere. And furthermore, we seem to like to interact with each other. So this is the other thing that evolutionarily we needed the brains we have, not to run away from the tigers, but to deal with each other.
That's Rao Kemenpati, ASU professor of computer science and engineering. The month of February was an extremely warm one in Arizona and incredibly dry. So if we take the next logical step, there's no reason to think we'd be able to generate drinking water from the air. But ASU professor Paul Westerhoff says not so fast, and he's with me to explain the possibilities of atmospheric water harvesting. Paul, what's the basic concept?
Yeah, so sometimes what's old is new, right? So along the Peruvian coast and in Chile, they used to have big nets that captured water out of the atmosphere, and that was more water vapor, or water droplets they'd capture out of the atmosphere. And you know, so if we fast forward that to, I don't know where you grew up, but I grew up in New Jersey. We had a basement. We had a dehumidifier in the basement, and the thing was loud, and you turn it on. It's kind of like a refrigerator in reverse, and you'd fill up these buckets and One of my jobs was dumping out all this water. And so I didn't think about it much then.
Yeah.
But so there's a whole range of these dehumidifiers for homes. Some of them are noisy. There's a new brand of these that are called desiccants. And they push water across kind of those little silica patches that you have in dried foods and stuff. And then so that absorbs water. And then it's a kind of a big desiccant wheel. It rotates around and a fan then blows warm air across and the water vapor comes off and it drips into a bucket again. But then during Hurricane Katrina, you have industrial scale size where they come in and they operate these desiccators to produce drinking water for people. So these are available.
So considering we're thinking about the effects of climate change and how that could affect a dry place like Arizona even more, how do you see this affecting things going forward? Is this one of those things that could help us worry about the drought perhaps in different ways than we're worrying about it now?
So there are power plants that have thought about taking all that water vapor that you see evaporating up. Essentially, they've distilled the water. And so can you capture and recover that? So it turns out one of the reasons they use water to evaporate to cool at power plants is it's a very good heat exchanger. And so there's a lot of thermal energy. So reversing that to recondense it can be quite a bit of work. But they have looked at this at kind of power plant scale. Mm-hmm. But now when we scale that down to what goes on in a home and can this solve our water problems today, it's going to change it could change the paradigm a little bit about how much you want to, say, desalinate ocean water, or do you want to take wastewater and repurify it to drinking water? So the concept is a little different here. Instead of taking things out of water, instead of taking the salt out, instead of taking pharmaceuticals out of water, it's really just taking the water out of the atmosphere.
So, Paul, I think, and maybe I'm simplifying the concept here, but when we talk about taking moisture from the air and turning it into something else we can use, the valley, at least, except in monsoon season, is a very, very dry place. Would that logically impact what we could get from it or not?
Yeah, so surprisingly, you can even 10 or 20% relative humidity, especially at night, you can suck water out of the atmosphere.
How much, first of all, do you think we need? Mm-hmm. And if we need it a lot, could this particular method end up producing a lot, or are we not quite even into that possibility yet?
So, Steve, if you wake up and brush your teeth and drink some water and cook some food during the day, each person needs about 5 to 8 liters of water per day. If you think about carrying around, that's quite a bit. So, 1 to 2 gallons of water. And so that's it. You can make that amount of high purity water with, maybe 2 square meters of area on your roof. And people have all different designs of these things. Some are, a meter by meter by meter. And it's really interesting to see what people are doing. But there's other kind of creative ways to find out where you can get moist environments. You said here in Arizona, it's awful dry. So we did a study where we looked at fuel cells. And here you take hydrogen or even natural gas that comes to your house and you put it into a fuel cell that converts that energy into electricity. And the byproduct is water. It takes hydrogen and combines it with oxygen in the atmosphere and makes water. And so we've hooked up some little recovery systems in there. They can generate for a typical house the amount of energy, electricity you need from a hydrogen fuel cell. You can generate about 16 liters of water. So that's enough to for a family of 4 or 5 to cook and do things with. So these things are possible. In fact, a large Japanese company actually has patents on this. And
wow,
it's a name brand that you'd hear every day.
Have you or any colleague you've worked with had a chance to drink the water from this concept and see what it tastes like?
So I've drunken some of the water that we had from one of these hydrogen fuel cell recovery systems. We've done advanced chemical analysis on it, and it's super clean.
ASU professor Paul Westerhoff, he's also senior advisor on science and engineering.
South by Southwest is one of the largest music festivals in the world, and at one time it was known as a place that could help launch artists' careers. While it's still considered a great place to personally discover music, the massive scale and success of the festival means that now bands' expectations have changed. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry speaks with 2 Arizona bands that have seen the festival take shape.
At a busy bar in downtown Austin, Valley band Jared and the Mill plays to a crowd of a few dozen fans listening intently, gently swaying and tapping their feet while they sing along. This is the band's 4th time at South by Southwest. Here's banjo player Michael Carter.
It's a good glimpse of what's going on right now and who's kind of making moves and who to go see. But at the same time, it's honestly just cool to see how the culture changes around music.
A few years ago, the festival may have been less of a barometer and more of an incubator, pushing musicians just beyond the threshold needed to gain massive popularity. But as the festival has grown, it's become harder for smaller bands to get booked at official showcases.
Every year it does get better here. I mean, we have 3 official showcases this year, which I was always felt like a huge blessing to get one.
That's Gabriel Sullivan, guitarist for the Tucson band Chicha. He's been coming since 2009, and bandmate Brian Lopez has since 2007. While they're enthusiastic to be here, time has tempered their expectations. Here's Lopez.
As the years have gone by, the shine has worn off, and it's more of a drag, and it costs a lot of money. They don't give you any money to be here. So we're here with very realistic goals.
Lopez said they'd like to make more concrete contacts, to be heard by other agencies, and to find opportunities to have their music placed in TV and film. While this isn't the same thing as suddenly being discovered and signing to a major record label, these kinds of incremental steps are important to a band. Jared Kolasar of Jared and the Mill says the festival is important for other reasons, too.
So it's a cool place where we can all come together and you meet other people, and it's a good way to, like, schmooze, and you get to catch some really awesome acts.
Acts like the legendary Leon Russell, who Jared and the Mill came to see in a crowded bar. Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News, reporting from South by Southwest in Austin.
And you can follow KJZZ's coverage of South by Southwest by visiting kjzz.org/sxsw.
It gives Superman a spot for a quick change. It takes Doctor Who through space and time. And now the phone booth is a place to hear poetry.
A new art installation called the Telepoem Booth will make its debut at the Mesa Art Center tomorrow. The show's Annika Klein gave it a ring.
For those who grew up with the phone booth as more of a pop culture icon than a practical tool, the Telepoem Booth comes with clear instructions.
Locate a telepoem number in the Telepoem book. Pick up the handset. Place finger in appropriate number hole on rotary phone. Rotate finger and dialing plate clockwise, all the way to the stopping bar.
With his kindergarten haircut and conspicuous plastic eyeglasses obscuring the geometry of his cheekbones through non-prescription lenses, Clark Kent is a super hipster.
And just like that, you've called a poem. That one you just heard was Malville by Phoenix poet Shante Orion. It's one of 220 poems available in the directory. Elizabeth Hellstern is the artist who dialed in on the idea.
Phone booths are amazing because they are a public communication booth that is entirely private.
The Telepoem Booth is a 1970s glass-paneled booth that Hellstern found on Craigslist. It's a true relic of the era because it was an actual phone booth. But you can't exactly use it to reach out and touch someone anymore.
No, it does not dial out.
Instead, it calls up MP3 files of poems. Poems from third graders, from established poets and new poets, from Arizona and out of state.
I really wanted the phone booth to be a place where the poets had an opportunity to let their voices be heard, and it was really looking for a democratic sprinkling of poets.
Shante Orion, the poet you heard earlier, says the phone booth is a venue he never imagined performing in.
It's exciting just, you know, to think that somebody, you know, just might stumble onto something that I wrote in a way that neither of us expected 2 months ago.
And it's definitely different than the live readings he's used to doing in front of an audience. Here, the caller has total control.
You might have had enough of this poem by now. You can hang up on a poet. How often do you wish when you were live you could just hang up on this person? Here you have the power, finally, to just end that poem.
The man of iron alloy ignores your Skype and text message pleas for help unless he stumbles upon a vintage phone booth.
When the caller steps out of the booth, Hellstern hopes the poems travel with them, and maybe they'll start to look for poetry in unexpected places.
I think it's been relegated to a stuffy back drawer category, and it's living words, and it's living beauty, and poets are people who stop and pause and look at beauty and record beauty. And the listeners are very important to that process because they're the ones who carry that beauty forward.
And if they want to revisit it, the poems are only one call away. It's the show. I'm Anika Klein.
The Telepoem booth will be at the Mesa Arts Center tomorrow and Saturday, then it'll travel to Flagstaff.
Today, March Madness tipped off with the men's NCAA basketball tournament. I'm going to stick with the big name programs, Mark, like North Carolina and Kansas.
I'm definitely, you know, going with the Porcupine and the Bison.
Okay, so you mean you pick the teams based on the mascot?
Oh, no, I'm talking about March Mammal Madness. It's a bracket going on right now that imagines what would happen if two mammals fought. You know, elephants, shrew versus giant anteater, that sort of thing. It was organized, can you imagine that?
I can't imagine the two of us going. We're two mammals.
That wouldn't be good. It was organized by Katie Hind with the Center of Evolution and Medicine at ASU, as well as a few other researchers.
So we, the organizers, have our version of a selection Sunday, and we've already picked out all of the species, and we do research on them. So we know about their body mass, we know about their weaponry, we know about their armor, and then we discuss what we think would happen. It's very, very nerdy.
So what are some of the divisions here?
Well, you've got your mighty giants, for example, which includes the giant forest hog and large tree shrew. All in all, 64 mammals competing to get to what they call the final roar.
Okay, so I'm definitely going to add that giant forest hog to my final roar.
Steve, that could actually be risky. Hind says sometimes there are upsets. They do all this research and calculate the probability of one animal winning, but then they use a random number generator to determine the outcome, and sometimes the underdog, or shrew, is the victor.
And that presents particular challenges. How do we justify an unlikely outcome? Because this is nature. Unlikely things do happen. Like we found out a couple years ago, Duke can go out quite early in the tournament. And so that's where we get to deeper research to write these battle narratives.
And last night, the Porcupine defeated the Bush Dog by attacking its face.
I had that one.
I had that in my bracket. You had that plus the points. And this fake fight was based on an account Hind had read about a real fight between a rodent and a canine.
Tonight, the most anticipated matchup will probably be anteater versus giant panda. Who's going to fight a giant panda? They're so cuddly. Come on. You can catch the action on Twitter by checking out at 2016MMM. Let's go.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.